According to our Bible, the matriarch Sarah remained barren until long past the term of childbearing. And then, quite unexpectedly, a son, Isaac, was born. At his birth, Sarah naturally experienced the surge of maternal joy. But at the same time, there was within her a nagging worry, anxiety lest her friends make joke at the circumstance of this birth. The Bible expresses Sarah's feelings in a single double-edged phrase. Tzachak asa li ha-Elohim, kol shomea yitzachak li. Which can be translated to mean either, God has made a laughing stock of me. All who hear will mock me. Or more generously, God has made laughter for me. All who hear will rejoice with me. Let us hope that the gossips of ancient Canaan had sufficient tact to press their congratulations upon Sarah without unnecessary humor. But be this as it may, the conceit that God has created laughter for me, for us, for all, is one which I think merits our consideration this morning. We seldom think of God as approving of good cheer or good times. We think of religion as black-suited and thin-lipped. And we tend to picture God as a stern, celestial judge, puritanical in his judgments, forbidding, foreboding in his manner, impatient with the pleasures which men allow themselves. And yet as far as Judaism is concerned, nothing could be further from the mark. Go, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with merriment. There is a time for weeping and a time for laughter, a time for mourning and a time for dancing. Judaism commands goodness, but it does not condemn gaiety. Every one of our holy days has its oneg, its aspect of joy, its celebration as a holiday. Come before the Lord with gladness. Appear before his gates with song. And though God is not to be pictured within our tradition, when the poets of our people dared to image God, they spoke of him not as a strict disciplinarian, but as Ne'el Rachum V'Chanun, a God of generosity of spirit, a merciful God, long-suffering, ever-patient. And one of these poets even dared to picture God as Yoshev Bashamayim Yisachak, as sitting in the heavens and chuckling at the pretensions of men, as if I may be forgiven the pun, the Creator who made woman out of the bone of man sits back in his heaven and enjoys the results of this gentle ribbing. Tzachak asa li ha-Elohim. God has made laughter for me, for all. And we are profoundly grateful. For to live is to be bruised. To live is to be bewildered. To live is to know worry. To live is to know loneliness and doubt. It's to hear the martial alarm. It's to know the nagging concern of a family and finance. It is to know ill health, debility, and senility. And as long as the dimensions of life are frailty and mortality and responsibility, so long does man require the gentle light of laughter to lift the weight of burden from his shoulders, to give him some sense of encouragement, some measure of perspective, a moment of release. For tension is released. The knots of tension within us are soothed by laughter. The loneliness within us is assuaged by laughter. The fear within us is put aside for the moment by laughter. Laughter gives us stature, strength. It gives us back our soul. Tzchak asa li ha'Elohim. God has made laughter for me. The laughter which reduces the walls of reserve and inhibition which stand between man and man. Phillips Brooks, the beloved Boston preacher of a century ago, was raised in a pious and God-fearing New England family, a family which looked to the local congregational minister as the source of values. He was much quoted and much adored. And Phillips Brooks stood in awe and respect of this man, but he knew as a youth that he wanted to meet him and know him as a man. But he found that whenever he came into his presence, he was tongue-tied, numb, awestruck. He acted the part of an infant, not of a youth. Until one Sunday luncheon at the minister's home, when the minister was regaling the assemblage with some slightly or largely embellished stories of his youth, the five-year-old daughter of the minister finally interposed, "Daddy, are these stories true or are you still preaching?" And in the laughter that followed, Phillips Brooks saw the minister as a man. He became the model on which he based his life. And you and I have all known men of tact and of charm who will deliberately tell on themselves some story in order to break through, to break up a conversational logjam. And so it is that laughter removes constraint. And if you have ever wondered, as I have, why there is such a spate of jokes, of stories told about ministers, priests, and rabbis, I submit that it is because through these stories, we remove the arbitrary theologies and the rituals which separate us as religionists, and we can see in the common experiences and the common confusions of our ministers our common existence as men. A half century ago, social Boston was aghast. Jewish immigrant by the name of Kibbutznik had dared to apply to the courts to Americanize his name to Cabot. Ponderous letters were written to the local press by the men and women of Beacon Hill. It was an affront to the history, to the noble lineage, to the Puritan history of Boston. A great deal of cant and a great deal of social pretense was spewed forth to the papers. Until one Boston wit and sage, somewhat more understanding than the most, printed side by side in the Boston Herald, in the letters to the editor, two quatrains, one familiar and one a parody. I come from dear old Boston, the land of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells speak only to the Cabots, and the Cabots speak only to God. Then the parody. I come from dear old Boston, the land of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells now speak to no one, for the Cabots speak Yiddish by God. And in their laughter at themselves, Boston learned to ingest and to take to its heart the Jewish immigrant who brought its strength and culture and a new depth to its middle class. For laughter removes the artificialities of title and place and allows us to see that all men share with us the dangerous and confusing journey of life. Laughter can teach us many things. I remember when I was a child, I had a child's fright of death. I peopled the cemetery with 1,000 ghosts and spirits. And like so many children, I held my breath as tightly as I could whenever I passed along a cemetery fence. When I was about 8 or 9, I was introduced to the wonderful folklore of the people of Chelm. Chelm was the capital of Eastern Europe of the Kingdom of Nunnikdom. Into Chelm, our Eastern European forefathers placed all their foolish wise men. And I remember reading at that time of the founding of the city. It seems the surveyors were called in, and they laid out the broad streets. In Eastern Europe, a broad street was as wide as a temple aisle. And they laid out the homes and the synagogue and the school. And then they faced a problem. How much land should be allowed for their Mayfield, for their cemetery? There was debate, much confusion, until finally the rabbi, the venerable sage of Chelm, raised his hand and said, "Stay, I have a solution. Come with me." And all of the people of Chelm, the babies and the aged, the town council and the village craftsmen, followed the rabbi to the appointed plot. "Lie down here, side by side," he commanded. And then with a stick, he circumscribed in the ground the appropriate acreage necessary, leaving, of course, sufficient space for himself. In this way, Chelm learnt the dimensions of its cemetery. In this way, I remember as a child, I learnt the naturalness of death. For more than the cold logic and the sweet reason of teacher or parent, the folk humor of this story stripped death for me of its fright. It became a natural part of life, something which I as a child could cope with, and though I know no more than I did then of its enigma, of what lies beyond the grave, I did learn to exorcise and exorcise the ghosts from the cemetery. I did begin to leave my fears behind. Laughter can teach. Laughter can reduce the tensions which stand between men. But there are laughters which are not healthy. There is humor which is sick. There is the laughter of the asylum, high-pitched madness, as the book of Ecclesiastes said. And I say of laughter, it is madness. There is a laughter which is at the expense of another. There is a shrill laughter of character assassination. There is a bitter, sadistic laughter of cruelty. But every appetite, every blessing, every love, every talent, all that we enjoy is capable of abuse. And this does not preclude our enjoying or recognizing the meaning of this virtue. But I remember a decade or more ago wondering what I felt of the humor that came out of Nazi Germany. The humor which the Jew created when he was about to be crushed to cinder under the Nazi heel. I felt then that it was a sick humor, a pathetic humor, a humor with which I could not cope. I could not understand its dimensions and its cause. You know the type of story. The setting in an American consular office in Poland. The long lines of patient, resigned, displaced people seeking exit, the immigration quota to the United States filled for 20, 30 years, the elder approaching the young consular official 20, 21 years of age at his desk, the plea, "I would like, sir, to emigrate to America. I need to leave." The response, "I'm sorry. Our lists are filled for Polish immigrants till June of 1974. The dropping of the shoulders. The realization that this last pathetic hope is gone. The turning around by the elder. The attempt of the young man, confused by the cold shoulder of his own bureaucracy, to reach out warmly and humanely to this man. "Well, perhaps, sir, you'd like to come back then." The slow turn of the elder. His look of understanding and sympathy with the young man, and yet the words that pass from his lips, "Would you like me to come back in the morning or the afternoon?" There is an old saying which we all know, that he who laughs last laughs best. I do not very much like it. It smacks of the vengeful. But if we shorten it, we can see, I think, a truth. He who laughs lasts. Laughter permits us sometimes to endure the unendurable. Studies of the men who suffered in the Nazi concentration camps reveal that they could maintain life, dignity, and sanity as long as they held to some ray of hope. If that hope was dashed and smashed, they became living corpses, more dead than alive. As long as men can hold on to some measure of hope, and humor is a way, laughter is a way of maintaining one's dignity, we stay alive. Whatever be the crushing, heavy-hammered blows which beat upon us, he who laughs lasts. And the attempts of the displaced in Germany to forge some humor, some laughter out of the unbelievable cruelty of their situation was simply an attempt to hold on to life and to sanity and to dignity and to take a long view. The story is told of the community of Breslau. The Jewish community there was one day ordered by the Gestapo to assemble in the congregation to hear a rebroadcast of one of Hitler's Nuremberg diatribes. Nazi guards surrounded the place. The radio was turned on full blast, and Hitler blasted out, "Our holy German soil must be free of the lice which our Jews, Germany must be Judenrein. We will purge them, we will destroy them." Then, to everyone's surprise, one of the venerable elders in the congregation began to chuckle and to laugh. The Gestapo guard rushed up and shook him by the shoulders. "How can you laugh at our Führer? How can you laugh when your doom has been pronounced?" "I'll tell you why. My people has heard other Hamans pronounce our doom. And I was thinking ahead to the time when my descendants would be enjoying a new holiday of Purim. A new carnival day would be added to our calendar because of what was said this day. And somehow taking this long view, leaping ahead into the future, this man, this community, and these people held on to life, continued, and some did survive because of this hope. But it is clear, is it not, that though laughter releases tensions, and laughter permits us hope when the skies threaten, laughter solves no problems. It relieves tensions, but does not remove the pressures which create these tensions. It is palliative, not therapeutic. Beyond laughter must be passion. If laughter gives us encouragement, we must be courageous. If laughter gives us new confidence, we must use this confidence to remove the tensions which surround us, to solve the problems which beset our homes and our family and our society. Laughter is a gift of God to give us daily courage to continue our work, but it is the work that is crucial and the work that must be done. I may laugh when someone tells to me that love is a dream and marriage the alarm clock. But it does not preclude my founding my own home in love, in stability, and my bringing to it laughter and learning and living which is dignified, uplifting, virtuous. I may laugh when someone talks to me of the overly sophisticated among our youth. I may laugh when I read on one of my confirmation papers the explanation of the fourth commandment, to honor thy father and thy mother. This means that your parents have brought you into the world and are raising you to the best of your ability. I may laugh and may be amused, but it does not lift from my shoulders the responsibility of preventing my own children from being worldly wise too young. from losing their childhood before they are prepared to lose it. I may laugh at the plight presented to me by a comic of the henpecked, harried husband in a fallout shelter, who after 3 days cannot make up his mind whether it is worse to suffer the slings and arrows of his wife's outrage or to brave the atomic fission without. But that does not lift from my shoulders the obligation to be a peacemaker, to prevent our society from becoming a civilization of human moles, to find with others like determined as I a way out of our present tensions and world conflict. Beyond laughter must be labor. Labor in the service of God. Labor in the service of man. Labor in the disciplining of our talents. For as laughter is a gift of God, it is given us as all his blessings are for a purpose, that we may be the stronger and the nobler and the more fit for our task as servants of him. Talmud tells of a certain Rabbi Baroka, Babylonian teacher, who was wandering the streets of his city when he chanced upon the prophet Elijah. Now, if a rabbi happens to meet Elijah, he never misses taking advantage of this opportunity. And Baroka had been much concerned with developing a series of lectures on the moral qualities most beloved by God. And so his first question to Elijah was this: "Tell me, Elijah, who among all those you see about here thronging the streets, who of these will merit a place in paradise?" And Elijah looked, and his eyes circumscribed the crowd, and he turned to Baroka and he said, "Not one." "Look again, still not one." "Oh, wait a minute. You see these two comedians entering the square? These two will merit sitting with God in paradise." "Comedians? Comedians are a rascally lot. They are intemperate in their habits. How can comedians, more than scholars and sages and business people, Elijah, have the merit to enter paradise?" But Elijah had disappeared, and Baroka was left with his problem. Perhaps he thought to himself, perhaps these comedians have performed some act of unexpected heroism that qualifies them for this signal honor. And he quizzed the comedians. No, they were ordinary folk, not very learned. They wandered about from place to place. They had performed no acts of courage or of heroism. Their only virtue, that each day they had brought laughter and smiles to the faces of their audience. And the Talmud was simply telling us the virtue of being one who gives happiness, the value of being among the builders of happiness, the givers of laughter to the world. And if we ask the logical next question, why is it then that civilization has never erected great statues or monuments to its professional fools and jesters, to those who puncture our pretenses and who allow us to see life in a new perspective, then must not the answer be that though it is a blessing to give laughter to another, to tell him a humorous tale, this is not enough? That beyond the laughter, there must be purpose. There must be a program. There must be a plan. That the professional comedian, the fool, the jester, seldom goes beyond the quip, the witticism, the humor. He has no program for life. He is sardonic, but not saintly. So if we can and when we can, let us help others to laugh. Let us learn sufficient humility to laugh when our own vanities are exposed. But let us be sure that when laughter eases our conscience, soothes our tension, relieves our loneliness, we use this new strength as God intended it to be used when he gave us the gift of laughter, for the purpose of bettering our society, of founding more securely our home, of training more straightly our talents, of equipping with more fact and more knowledge and more technique our minds. For for using our strength as God purposed that it be used in the service of